Hello and welcome to Inside the Euros. We're back in the middle of the round of 16 with Italy and Belgium beating Austria and Portugal respectively to set up a quarter-final clash, while Denmark thrashed Wales and Czech Republic stunned the Netherlands. I'm Rick Sharma.
And I'm David Gibbs.
And we're pleased to welcome back Joe Casanelli from sunny Copenhagen. Hello, Joe.
Hi, guys. Good to be with you.
You're there for the Spain game, right?
Yeah, here for Spain, Croatia, and quite frankly, I never want to leave. If anyone's ever been, I'd thoroughly recommend Copenhagen. Beautiful city, lovely, lovely docks area where I am at the moment. It's in a big public swimming pool that I can see that's free to use, and they're very clean Scandinavian water. Everyone's happy and smiling. There's a lot of bikes, and you know, I'm a big cycling fan as well, so a beautiful place.
We'll also be hearing from Dutch football expert James Rowe on the Netherlands knockout. We start though with Portugal against Belgium, a 1-0 win for the Red Devils. This was the biggest tie of the tournament so far, given it meant a favourite was eliminated from the competition. And that's your Portugal, Jay. I say your because you were with them all through that 2016 Euros triumph.
Yeah, well, I see. It was actually quite strange watching it because despite having no family ties or links to Portugal, I still kind of oddly found myself, you know, wanting them to win and stay on. You know, you obviously when you're with them and working with them on a daily basis, it's different, but this is sort of 5 years down the line, but it's interesting to know that it's still that little link still stayed there. And, you know, I was egging them on towards the end, I think, but I think, to be honest, it was more that the game was just so entertaining that I just really wanted another half an hour of it more than it being sort of wanting Portugal to win, because ultimately, you know, whoever would have won after 120 minutes, you'd have been happy. It was a really, really good game. And, you know, one of the games, you know, I've been very fortunate.
I mean, I thought the first half was bad. First half was terrible. Second half was exciting because the pressure ramped up with Portugal needing to equalise.
It's probably recency bias, isn't it? It's recency bias in that, you know, it's like you go to a rock concert, they play a banger at the start, all the trash in the middle, and then they do their encore with, you know, another famous number, and you just remember the start and the end and you forget about the middle bit. So maybe it was a bit like that. I think that I thought the second 45 minutes were some of the best 45 minutes in the tournament. And I've been lucky enough to be at the Germany-Portugal game as well. And it was just, it was, again, you know, football of the highest quality. And you're kind of looking at some of the sides who will make it through to the quarterfinals, and you think, you know, you've got to kind of feel, you do have to feel sorry in a way for Portugal, in that, you know, they met Belgium at such an early stage of the tournament. But then you've got to say, on the flip side, well, if you'd have done better in the group stage, then you wouldn't have met Belgium. And, you know, if you'd have done better in the group stage, you could well be facing England and be on that more appetising side of the draw as it's currently looking. So, yeah, I mean, I really, really thought that that, you know, Portugal were unlucky, I think, is how I describe it. I think that they were probably the better team, although, you know, you can probably, you know, I sound like I'm contradicting myself, and I know that I am, and this happens quite a lot, but Belgium always felt like they probably had another gear to go up if they needed to, whereas I thought that Portugal were sort of playing to their absolute max, and they didn't actually create too many clear cuts. They had a lot of shots, but a lot of them, you know, considering that Thibaut Courtois is one of the world's best goalkeepers, I'm not really sure why they decided that shooting from 30 yards, you know, every couple of minutes would be the best way to try and score. Because ultimately, you know, he's one of the world's best goalkeepers and doesn't easily get beaten from there. But that appeared to be an obvious tactic of theirs. And it wasn't really until late on that they created anything clear cut. You know, Jota fired one over the bar, and then probably the best chance of the game for them was that Ruben Diaz header where, you know, he's really got to score. He's 6 yards out with a free header.
Courtois made some very good saves. And like you say, Jota missed that chance. Never seems to be as good for Portugal as he's been for Liverpool this season. Fernando Santos, the Portugal coach, made some curious decisions because all three starting midfielders in this game didn't start in the first match of the tournament, which is a drastic kind of change of your first team. And then he brought on João Félix for his first game. I know he had an injury problem earlier, but it seemed like a curious time to bring on a player who hasn't played yet. And it was just altogether a little bit curious from the coach. And then eventually Bruno came on, and he at least was much better than in any of the games so far. Bruno in the last 20-30 minutes or so of the game was really putting the pressure on Belgium.
One of the things that I will point out about Fernando Santos, or Old Gil from The Simpsons, as I think he's come to be known on social media, is that he really does learn from his mistakes and he learns and adapts quite quickly, because it was exactly the same in 2016. In 2016, he started with a different midfield in the first two games of the group stage, eventually settled on a midfield that then won them the tournament. And, you know, it was the same case this time around, again, with, you know, Renato Sanchez, Moutinho and Paiña starting. They were really, really good, I thought, in midfield. I thought Renato Sanchez in the first hour as well was fantastic. But I was saying to a colleague who I watched a game with, was that I actually thought his substitutions hamstrung Portugal a little bit, because he was taking off, he was taking off players who were really key to the system, and they almost didn't appear to have, you know, Portugal were known for being so rigid and having this set system. And that all seemed to kind of just go out of the water. You know, he takes off Bernardo Silva and brings on João Félix. So, you know, for all, you know, all of his attacking talents, he's not got the same work rate and defensive capabilities as Bernardo. You're looking at, he's taken Moutinho off, who's a man who can sit in a system and does a very functional job. You bring on Bruno Fernandes, and then, I mean, it's quite strange, actually, because I thought that Bruno Fernandes was very, very poor in the first couple of games that he played for Portugal, and that he was rightly dropped. And then, I mean, I know what you mean in that he was giving it to Belgium, but to be honest, all kind of I saw was him coming on the pitch and just being trying to take out Eden Hazard for about half an hour. So that's all he appeared to be doing. And it just, like, every time you saw him, he was just standing on Hazard's ankle. You know, and Hazard, I think when Hazard got that injury, I think he was running away from Bruno Fernandes as well. So, I mean, if Portugal didn't, you know, knock Belgium out, they did a very good job of making sure that they'd be without quite a lot of players for their quarterfinal against Italy anyway. But the Fernando Santos thing is strange.
Well, yeah, that Paulinha's best moment in theory for Portugal was taking out Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah, I thought that could have been a big changing point in the game. And, you know, Portugal is a strange side in that they've got such great attacking talents and players, but they play in such a rigid defensive system that they're quite hard to love as well, I think, given, you know, what they could be and what they are. And ultimately, I think that caution's probably cost them. And the chap I watched the game as well said to me, you've got to wonder, though, if Portugal do score an equaliser, how are they going to approach extra time? Because they were essentially playing with like five forwards. And it's like, I understand, you know, needs must and desperation. But if you've got to play another half an hour where Belgium still had three substitutes left up their sleeve at that stage. So you were kind of wondering, you know, what was the game plan? But it was just ultimately a fight for survival that they ended up losing. And I think that, you know, I don't think that Santos's job is in any danger. He's got a very good record. He won Euro 2016. He won the Nations League. So I don't think that's any danger, but I think he maybe needs to kind of, you know, learn his team better ahead of a major tournament. Because, as I said, 2016, he flipped and flopped, and ultimately they were lucky to get out of the group, but he eventually settled on a midfield that went and won it for them. And, you know, who knows, if he'd have found that midfield combination earlier this tournament, then maybe they'd have beaten like a wounded Germany side and finished, you know, second or first in the group, and ultimately have not faced Belgium in the last 16 and been knocked out.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think you made a good point as well about the subs, because when Portugal brought them on, they did seem to lose a bit of their shape and idea. And that whole system is built around Cristiano Ronaldo, and he seemed to be a little bit lost when all the other substitutes were on. And the narrative's over, Gibbo. There's, you know, this Cristiano Ronaldo, amazing at 36, scoring five goals. They were all tap-ins and penalties, and now he's out of the tournament. He didn't get his 110th goal, which would have broken Ali Day's record and been the top men's international goal scorer of all time. I know he will get there. He'll just get there in the next friendly they play against Andorra or some team they'll pick for him to be able to score a bunch of goals, basically. And he just kept taking free kicks yesterday, and they weren't very good. And he scored one free kick in his last 50-something for Portugal.
Yeah, I think the narrative of Ronaldo taking free kicks is someone needs to start putting rank on that now. But I think Bruno should have probably had a good chance. Like Joe said, Portugal don't really know their team. I don't think the manager knows his team. With international football, you do need to have a good team that can play. And I think they're a bit like Belgium a few years ago, where they've got all these superstars and players, but they don't know how to combine them as one. And that's their problem. I mean, talking of Ronaldo, I mean, he is still the European Championship all-time record finals goal scorer. So that's an achievement you can't take away from him, and it's going to be very, very hard for that to be beaten, I think. And you say it'll be a friendly against Andorra, that they've actually got a European qualifier against the Republic of Ireland in the Algarve, so in the start of September. Hopefully there'll be fans back for that, where he can break the record. The Irish aren't in good nick at the moment, so I'd probably lump my mortgage on that for him to break the record.
And you mentioned about free kicks there, Gibbo. I mean, while you say someone's got a pull rank on Ronaldo, I don't think even if the president of Portugal laid down a national decree, I don't think that anyone would be taking free kicks of Cristiano Ronaldo, despite the fact his record isn't fantastic. And while and the odd thing with Portugal as well is that while Bruno Fernandes is quite good at free kicks, I think that maybe. He's decent at free kicks, but he's probably not the very, very top free kick takers in the game. Maybe that's just my anti-Manchester United bias coming out there. But he's very good at set pieces and putting in crosses rather than shooting, I think. However, they do have Rafael Guerreiro, who takes them for Borussia Dortmund, and he's fantastic. And there's a couple of free kicks that were really well suited to left footers. He's obviously the left back, and there were a couple of free kicks they had. There was the one that Ronaldo forced that save from Courtois in the first half from memory, but it was a long way out and it was on completely the wrong side for a right-footed player to take it. And that's the kind of place where someone needs to be able to take it other than him. And I know a lot of people call him selfish, and I can completely understand why. And, Rick's Barcelona resident Rick's jibes are obviously there. But so one of the things you've got to say about Ronaldo is he almost kind of wants to win too much for Portugal. You've got to remember back to 2016, how what it meant to him. There was there's obviously those iconic pictures of him on the sideline, having been substituted for injury, the way he's pushing on to always try and score that extra goal. Or you see how angry he gets even when in these so-called 6-0 friendly drubbings of Andorra or Liechtenstein or whoever. But you've got to say, fair play to him. He turns up to all the friendlies. The reason he's got 109 international goals is the fact that he never turns down a call up to his international team. He's always there. He's the captain. He always wants to play for them. And you've got to say that's really admirable, because this, especially nowadays in football, this club versus country debate is so hot and raging. And you see a lot of you remember like Ryan Giggs's international career with Wales. He'd always he'd coincidentally always pick up sort of like a little hamstring injury just before any friendly match that was going to be played. Sir Alex Ferguson was it's kind of like a running joke that he was known for the tactical injuries just at an international break. So Cristiano Ronaldo, you've got to say, like, you've got to applaud his will to play for his country. And there's a Ronaldo versus Messi debate, and you can have your own opinions on that. And personally, I think that Messi is a better all-round footballer and just a better footballer in general than Cristiano Ronaldo. But you look at their records for their countries, and you've got to say that Cristiano Ronaldo's record for Portugal is fantastic. He's won the Euro, he's won the Nations League. He also always turns up for them, whereas Messi has this thing of retires from international duty because he doesn't like the president of the FA, or he's a bitch, a bit annoyed, and he's because everyone else is crap, so he retires from international duty and comes out of it for the tournament, and he's like flip-flopping in and out. And you've got to say, at least with, say, Cristiano Ronaldo, is that he's always been there for Portugal. And I think you maybe saw at the end of the game last night, he kind of was probably acknowledging that it was his last Euro and his last chance to help Portugal win the Euro. So I think that it was maybe also for them that the sort of end of an era in that sense, because there's quite, Pepe as well, where he's 38 years old and he's not going to go to another Euro. So I think there's a lot of players in that Portugal squad that are primed for a generational switch. But, their under 21s got to the final of the Euro this year. Diogo Dalot, who played in that game against Germany in the final of the under 21s, also started last night and did a lot better than Nelson Semedo's done in any of the games so far. So, you know, the future also looks bright for them.
I don't know if you've seen the clip that's going around. It's at full time with Ronaldo shaking hands with Thibaut Courtois, sort of like he basically says, lucky, hey. And then Thibaut's like, the ball didn't want to go in, you know, and they wish each other luck in the next round. And I think that's a nice moment in it. And it goes back to your point there, Joe, of, you know, Ronaldo does care. He does try. He might not look it, but he's desperate to succeed with Portugal.
Yeah, completely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, Courtois had a point. You know, he didn't really have that much to do in the group stage. And then all of a sudden last night, he was really busy. But as you say, I think that it's just... I'm just sounding like a Ronaldo fanboy here, and I'm really not one of them. But it's just, I just think it's admirable the way that he, you know, really does give it all for his country. I'm not a huge patriot, so to speak, and like I'm not one of those people who's, you know, oh, you play, you know, your country this, but you can see what it means to a lot of players to play international football, especially when a major tournament comes round, and you know, the disappointment is going to be there, but at least they weren't, you know, they weren't, you know, the game threatened to boil over as well at some point. You know, there was a few tackles flying in where you thought Pepe is probably going to get a red card here any minute because he seemed to be just on, you know, on the cusp of boiling over sort of throughout that second half. But in the end, it was all fun and games, and you know, they kind of kick the living daylights out of each other, but were able to shake hands at the end of it and wish each other luck.
Belgium, on the other hand, are through having played a very strong team. You seem a bit more convinced about them now than you were at the start. They've kind of proven they're not, you know, that defence is, while it's, you know, a bit old and a bit rickety, they did hold off Portugal yesterday for 90 minutes.
Not particularly, in that Portugal still had quite a few chances towards the end. You know, as I said, you know, the Jota shot, the Ruben Dias header where he was in the middle of the goal, 6 yards out. And if he puts it, you know, even say 20 centimetres either side, he's definitely scoring a goal there. Like the marking in general from the set pieces, I thought was really poor. I actually thought that Portugal, if they were going to score, was probably actually going to be from a corner. And, you know, while I maybe criticise Bruno, you know, for essentially just coming on and hacking down Eden Hazard every few minutes, he put in quite a few good corners when he came on, I must say. And that I think that that defence, you know, there were times when balls were played over the top, and you know, Ronaldo would be sprinting and Vertonghen would be sprinting after him, and you'd say, God, that'd be a good race 8 years ago in the Premier League, wouldn't it? But I think that if that's not Ronaldo, or sort of this incarnation of Ronaldo, that's Kylian Mbappe, then I still think that they're in trouble. There's still huge spaces in behind that back line, and I still think that ultimately against a strong, even, you know, like in England, with the pace that England have got up front, I still think that they would cause Belgium a number of problems. But as I guess it's at the other end where Belgium are such a threat, because as I said, they look like at any point they could just go up a gear. And there was a couple of times on the counter-attack with Portugal chasing the game where, you know, if the right pass is played, you know, if it's Kevin De Bruyne instead of Yannick Carrasco on the ball, it's probably a goal.
And Belgium, moving on, they play Italy, who needed extra time to get past Austria on Saturday with a 2-1 win, all the goals coming in that additional period. They're unbeaten in 31 games now, but they had to sweat for it at Wembley, didn't they?
Yeah, they really did. It's, but I think this was also one of those cases that we spoke about of a side not having home advantage, having to then go and play in a stadium. Well, sorry again. Yeah, they did. I think this is a case of one of those sides struggling to adapt to the fact they don't have home advantage, because they essentially were so, so strong at the Stadio Olimpico with that, you know, raucous fan base behind them, that all of a sudden when you're taken out of that comfort zone, it takes a bit of adapting to do. And, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on this later. Denmark did that so well playing away from Copenhagen. Whereas for Italy, it seemed to actually be the other way around. They really didn't cope with it all that well. And, you know, but for a slightly missed time run from Marko Arnautović, things could have been so different. And I also think that you've got to say, you know, fair kudos to Austria, because nobody really gave him a chance against Italy. And they really did put up a good fight. And if they'd have gone through, then you probably maybe friend of the podcast, Vieri Capretta, would disagree. But you probably couldn't have had any complaints if Austria had won that game.
Yeah, absolutely not. I thought Austria were fantastic. They went for it at least, because Franco Foda, the coach, in the first couple of games has been very defensive. And then in the third group game, they were much more attacking against Ukraine. And they kept that same high-pressing style, did themselves proud. And if he just made a few changes earlier on in the game, they might have been able to win that in the second half. For example, Kalajdzic, the tall 6'7" striker, came on. He's the guy that scored their one goal eventually, a fantastic diving header, despite being pulled back in the box. If he'd have come on, you know, half an hour earlier or in normal time, then maybe Austria could have gone on and won that, because Italy were rocking in the second half. And it wasn't until Federico Chiesa scored the opening goal in extra time, which was, for me, I know there's the shit goal, which is going to be impossible to beat as goal of the tournament. But apart from that, ignoring the shit goal, that for me has been the best goal so far. And it was also one of the best moments of the tournament. That control of the pass from Spinazzola coming across to him with his head, and it looked like he'd lost control, but he somehow chopped it back inside, and then a superb finish.
Yeah, well, I think if you remember back to our preview of the tournament, I actually said that Fede Chiesa might be in the team of the tournament. So he's made a couple of massive contributions in the last couple of games for Italy. He's really got to be pushing, you know, to be one of the stars of the tournament, I think, if, you know, Italy can progress and if he starts against Belgium. But yeah, I think moving back to Foda there, it's one of them, of that probably is what separates the top managers at the very highest level, their ability to seize the initiative and really go for it, rather than still just having that little bit of a handbrake on. And okay, Austria as well, the quality in their side compared to the quality in the Italian side or many of the other international sides at this stage of the tournament is probably not all there. So you can forgive him for probably thinking we have to play within our means. We can't just go gung-ho. And then you've got to think of, if they went gung-ho for it and all of a sudden Italy score two because they've just got no defensive structure or no midfield shape, then he's probably thinking, you know, if that happens, then, you know, everyone's going to say I was tactically naive, and, you know, rightly so. So it's obviously if buts and maybes, and hindsight is a wonderful thing. But they did themselves justice, they did themselves proud. And I think that I was reading, you know, quite a few articles and, you know, following some people on Twitter about it. And it seems that this one thing that this Euro has done, just not only for Austria, but in general, is it's united a lot of countries and made a lot of people fall back in love with their national teams. And I think that Austria are a really good example of that, because there was a lot of dissenting voices going into the tournament about how Foda was only picking players from the German Bundesliga. Why was he ignoring the Austrians in the Austrian league? You know, and I think he's probably shown that the guys who are playing in the German Bundesliga are actually just better players. And the reason that they're in the national team is that they're playing in a higher level, and they're better players. And people have kind of bought into that now, rather than harking back to the, you know, why has he got to pick all those the foreign based lads? And also, as we'll talk about this later, where I am in Copenhagen, there's Denmark flags absolutely everywhere. You know, and I spoke to a colleague of mine yesterday who said that this Euro has completely reunited a divided country. There's been a lot of problems, you know, socioeconomic problems to do with immigration and, you know, taxes and all that kind of stuff, and the whole Euro has just managed to bring everyone back together and unite and pull in one direction. And I think Austria is maybe another example of that.
Joe is in Copenhagen, sinking Danish lager. I'm on the Cañas, and Gibbo has a free case of 8 unique craft beers from Beer 52. We've partnered with them for the Euros to bring you a genuinely really good deal. Go to beer52.com/Euro2020 or use the code Euro2020 on the website. and you get a free case of 8 craft beers. You just pay the postage costs of $5.95, which is the cost of a pint, and you get 8 beers. It's the world's largest beer club, 178,000 active members. Each month, members are sent out a case with a different theme, including Belgium, Korean beers, Californian beers, and many more. It comes with a magazine and a tasty snack, and if you don't like dark beer, you can choose an option for just getting light beers in your pack. You can pause or cancel your subscription at any time, so just go to beer52.com/Euro2020, use the code Euro2020, and just pay that $5.95 postage and packaging to get your set of 8 beers. This offer only applies to people living in the UK. Perhaps the shock result of the round came with the Netherlands being turfed out 2-0 by the Czech Republic in Budapest. Goals from Holles and Schick did the business after De Ligt was sent off for the Netherlands. Lots of puns were available in this one. Both scorers and De Ligt are all very punnable names.
And we all know that you are a massive fan of puns, Rick, as well. So that's I'm sure that was music to your ears when you saw it all happening. And I also think that you know, the Netherlands coach, you could maybe call him Defraud
Depoor
as well. There's another pun there. Depoor, Defraud. I think we've got plenty of them. And, you know, talking of defraud and defrauding your fans, the Netherlands really did just do that, because this was another example of a side struggling to play a game not in front of their home crowd. You know, they were so good in Amsterdam, but when you've got, you know, what is, you know, half full, unfortunately, a half full stadium cheering you on and getting right behind you, you know, it's not easy to play, but...
It wasn't half full, but it was, the other half was just full of Czech Republic fans, because it's quite easy for them to get to Budapest to just drive down in 2 or 3 hours.
No. What I mean is that, when they're in Amsterdam, when the Netherlands in Amsterdam with a half full crowd, it's quite easy for them to play and, you know, to be on the front foot. But then when you're taken out of that situation, then you know, as a player, it's going to be odd for you, because essentially you've gone from playing in front of empty stadiums to playing in front of stadiums only full of your own fans to then being in a stadium not full of your fans. It's probably a really weird psychological thing for the players, and ultimately they paid the price for that, and they were just really, really disappointing, having been so, you know, fantastic in the group stage. And I think that the key part of the game was, I think it was 27 seconds, their television analysis said, you know, from Netherlands missing a one-on-one chance that Vatelić actually did really well to save. I think it was Marlon who was running through on goal, and he came out and smothered him at his feet. You know, striker should have done better. And then 27 seconds later, De Ligt being shown a red card for playing handball, essentially.
Yeah, that was the moment the shit hit the fan for the Netherlands, really. That exact change from being almost one goal up, and it was very poor attacking play by Marlin, just lacked confidence when it came to taking it round Vatelić. Didn't hit the ball far enough, and the goalkeeper just intercepted it. Can't deny the goalkeeper anything. Great save, or great goalkeeping, as Joe said. And then suddenly De Ligt slips at the other end, and Gary Neville said it. He said, "It's not unlucky that he slipped. It's just bad positioning and bad body work. That's, you know, that's why you slip as a defender, because you don't get yourself in the right position." And he just made a silly handball. And I don't think there was any need for that. I think the Netherlands would be much better off a goal down with 11 men than getting De Ligt sent off there in a game that had become very even. And then the Czech Republic after that were just on cruise control. They just eased past the Netherlands with that goal from Holles. It was shambolic goalkeeping from Stekelenburg, which reflects badly on De Boer, because he kicked out Jasper Cillessen for COVID at the start of the tournament, even though he had said that he would keep him for a while, despite that. And then he decided, get rid of him, put Stekelenburg as number one. Well, Cillessen would have been fine by this point. He'd have been playing again if he hadn't been sent home. So he should have stuck, like Luis Enrique did with Busquets, should have stuck with him.
It's one of those things in that you've got to look at it from the coach's point of view as well. I completely get what you're saying, but it's like Portugal with João Cancelo as well, who tested positive 2 days before the tournament. You don't know how they're going to suffer and how they're going to recover from COVID. It's one of those things of some people will have long COVID, other people may have zero symptoms. So I think you've got to kind of err on the side of caution. And you've also got to think, well, what am I going to say to this guy? This guy could come in and play really, really well for two or three games. And then all of a sudden, like, all right, thanks for that. Thanks for saving that penalty that got us through. But you're out of there now because Jasper's back and I want him to play. So I can see why he didn't keep Cillessen in around the squad. And I think maybe Busquets is a little bit different given that he's the country's captain. And especially after, you know, Spain lost, they didn't select Sergio Ramos, and therefore we're lacking in experience anyway. Losing Busquets would have been another hammer blow to that. So I can see why they did that. I think the bigger question is that, you know, Martin Stekelenburg, who was, you know, Fulham's goalkeeper when they got relegated, if I'm not wrong, Gibbo, and, you know, he was the Everton substitute goalkeeper for a while. I mean, is he really the best goalkeeper that Holland can have to be as their second choice? I think it's more a question of it, and I'm pretty sure he's in his late 30s as well.
Yeah.
So it's one of them of, you know, is there not a better option out there than, say, Martin Stekelenburg to be that goalkeeper? You know, as you say, it was really poor goalkeeping, and, you know, anyone can make a mistake, but at this level you get punished for them. And I think that maybe the larger question, rather than, you know, the De Boer selection and, you know, not keeping Cillessen around the squad, is why are the Dutch goalkeepers, you know, this is a country that's produced, you know, Cillessen, Van der Sar was there for, you know, for like the best part of 20 years as their national team goalkeeper as well. So what's happened to all the good Dutch goalkeepers, essentially, is maybe the bigger question. And I completely agree with it. If De Ligt, I mean, there's every chance that the Czech Republic don't score from when De Ligt slipped as well. It's not as if, you know, he's on the line and hooking it off the line with his hand. He's, you know, he's outside the box. And I think he maybe showed a bit of his naivety, because you've got to remember he's still a very young player. And I think that young players are more susceptible to doing that kind of thing, where, you know, if he'd have been at Juve for a couple of more years and been around, you know, the likes of Chiellini's, you know, he's probably, well, one, his positioning is probably better, and two, he probably doesn't make that reckless decision that ultimately costs his side their place at this tournament.
There was De Ligt for the Czech Republic, though, with their goals that sent them through. And maybe we should have known this was going to come, because, Joe, you backed them pre-tournament. And I also had an email from a PR company boasting about some supercomputer they had that worked out the results of the Euros. And they said that the Czech Republic were going to win. So maybe we should trust in the supercomputer, trust in Joe Casinelli.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with the second part of that. Wasn't the supercomputer also said they beat Denmark in the final, didn't it, as well, I think?
That's true, which is impossible now because they meet in the next round.
Can we really trust a supercomputer? One man you can. No, I'm only joking. But obviously, I just fancied them. They're a good side. You know, Vacilic as well is maybe one of those players who's got a point to prove. He spent the season on the bench in Seville. He lost his place to Yassine Bonu towards the end of last season, then spent a whole season on the bench, and I believe his contract ran out or will run out in a couple of days. So he's a guy who's playing for a move. He's got a point to prove. You know, you got the West Ham duo, who've had brilliant seasons in the Premier League, who are, you know, much admired in England. You know, Patrick Schick's one of those players who you probably never know what he's going to do. He's capable of doing, you know, what he did against Scotland, and, you know, that beautiful, delicate little finish from yesterday, but he's also probably capable of missing an open goal as well. He's one of those players who you just really don't know what's going to happen, but he's got a really good chance of finishing as a tournament's top scorer. Now Portugal are out, so the Czechs are, and they're just a very obdurate side. They just decide to, you know, England beat them in the group stage, but it was a really, like, they're capable of turning any game into a turgid affair. And, you know, the whole notion of playing at our level is very applicable to them. They're kind of a side who can make you play their kind of football in the way that they want the game to be played. And yeah, and I think it bodes well. And it's, you know, for them and Denmark, what an opportunity this is, to be honest with you, because, you know, whoever wins that game is 90 minutes away from a final. And, you know, especially Germany and England have both shown that they're pretty fallible as well, if they were to progress to that stage of the tournament.
talk about this Netherlands defeat, I turn to James Rowe, who's been living in the country for 15 years, interviewing Dutch players, coaches and more. That's all available on the Secret Footballer website. And James often speaks on TalkSport, Love Sport Radio and contributes to BBC articles about the Dutch national team. James, the Netherlands are out wild, wasn't it?
Very much a shock to the system, although if you was to listen to the Dutch media, you could see it was coming because they kind of took the Czech Republic as a little bit of a little bit too much for granted, where it appeared that they were plotting their semi-final date with the rivalry of the German national team to pencil that in the diary, without forgetting that there was a football match that needed to be played in Budapest, and things didn't happen for them today, and selection wasn't great, the drive wasn't there, and the Czech Republic wanted it more, and they ran out worthy winners.
I heard Mario Melcher, now you mentioned that, I heard Mario Melcher on the BBC today saying that he was quite happy with the Czech Republic because it, of all the teams that they could have got in the draw or in the way the tournament structured, that the Czechs were the easiest team.
Well, I think it just goes to show for the people that are football fans and have covered football for many, many years. At tournament football, regardless of level, there are always surprises. You only have to go back through history, especially the European Championships, to know that Denmark won it in 92, Greece won it in 2004, Czech Republic reached the final in 1996. We will have a semi-final finalist this time round in Denmark or the Czech Republic. It really is anybody's tournament. And considering the situation with the pandemic and players coming from such short pre-seasons to the national team set up, I think it just kind of bodes even more for potential surprises. And I think that there was always hope with Frank de Boer with the national team, but it stems more, Rick, from the facts of what he achieved as a player. When you look at his appointment, he was relieved of his duties at Crystal Palace, Inter Milan and Atlanta United. And to be relieved of your duties at those three clubs and then become Dutch national team manager, it doesn't bode well, really. And there was often a lot of talk here in the Netherlands about systems coming away from the traditional 4-3-3. There was a reliance on the forward drive of Frenkie de Jong. And then as someone who watched Frenkie de Jong when he broke through here, you know, he was kind of playing in like a withdrawn quarterback role and he's got much more presence now. But I think even for the tackles that he receives from opponents that are well-timed tackles, he seems to get irritated. And he never learned that in the youth setup at Willem II. He certainly didn't learn that here at Ajax in Amsterdam. And I think I can understand the will to win at Barcelona, but I think these traits that are creeping into his game is also something that's a little bit unsavoury in my opinion.
That's interesting to hear. I mean, I've seen a lot of Frenkie as I cover Barcelona, so I'm not so much this season when I've only been able to watch on TV into the last few games, but I've been to see him a lot. And I don't think of all the Netherlands players today, I wouldn't have pinned anything on Frenkie. I thought he had an okay game. I was more surprised by Wijnaldum not really showing up today after a fantastic start to the tournament. And Memphis Depay was, for me, at his kind of worst today with giving away the ball a lot.
Well, first and foremost, I was just giving an example as to the difference that I've seen in Frenkie de Jong since he's gone to Spain. And that's just my personal opinion. It's not so much about digging him out today. I tweeted and translated a lot of post-match interviews, with the likes of Dumfries, Wijnaldum, Frank de Boer, Matthijs de Ligt, and also Frenkie de Jong. And they were saying about that they certainly didn't underestimate the Czech Republic, but things did get difficult after the red card. And that the heat as well also played a factor. And the fact it was 29 degrees at kickoff. And the fact that even Frenkie de Jong said that they had the feeling that they could have achieved more. And Matthijs de Ligt was also saying that they had the feeling after the three games in Amsterdam that they were really growing into the tournament. And then to have exited so early after leaving Amsterdam is a little bit of a painful defeat to take. But there was questions about Frank de Boer's future, literally after when he first came on to do his post-match interview. But like he said, now is not the time. It's about evaluating. And I would be surprised if anything happens before the end of the 2022 World Cup qualification. I think he will get to see that out at the very least. And if they don't qualify automatically, I think then you may see a change.
This is perhaps more interesting to Barca fans than anything else, but just made me think, what if Ronald Koeman is let go at the end of his contract with Barca? He's got one more year. Is there a chance that he could, in theory, come back and take over for the World Cup?
Well, he had a clause in his contract, Rick, which allowed him to leave for Barcelona if they came in for him. But you also have to remember, this is a manager who's coveted the Barcelona job ever since he became a manager in his own right. He started out at Vitesse here in the Netherlands back in 2003 and also coached and managed Ajax, Feyenoord and PSV. But you have to remember, when he took the Valencia job in 2007, in the middle of his first press conference, Ronald Koeman says, yes, this is a great step to become Barcelona manager one day. And when I read those quotes, I thought to myself, at that time, you are managing the third biggest club in the whole of Spain. This was before the era of Simeone's Atletico Madrid.
Whether Koeman could come back to be Netherlands coach, what percentage chance would you give him to be Netherlands coach at the World Cup next year?
I would give it a 15% chance. They say never go back, but football makes its own rules, as we know. But I think should De Boer not get the automatic place for the World Cup in Qatar, and bearing in mind they're in a group with Norway, Turkey, and the away game against Latvia in Riga is not going to be easy. They still have to go to Riga. They still have to go to Oslo. They still have to play Norway in Rotterdam. They still have to play Turkey in Amsterdam. So it's by no means a given. And it's important to qualify for a World Cup again after missing Euro 2016 and also the World Cup in 2018.
It was good to see the Netherlands back at a major tournament, and not just for the fans, but just in general. I mean, I grew up with World Cup 98 being my first World Cup, and they had a big part in that and everything. And I even thought that goal from Italy the other day reminded me of Dennis Bergkamp against Argentina. Not quite as good as Bergkamp, but a similar kind of emotion to come back inside and shoot. But on the Netherlands tournament this time around, every step of the way, they seemed to have confounded what was expected of them, because coming into the tournament, like you say, there was a lot of criticism of De Boer and the formation shift to five at the back or three with wing backs, whatever you want to call it. And yet they went and wiped out every team in that group, got 100% record. And then when everyone was saying, oh, actually, the Netherlands are quite good, they go and get knocked out today.
The manner upon which the tournament has manifested itself, where you've got Denmark playing all their games at Copenhagen, the Netherlands playing all their games in Amsterdam, Italy playing all their games in Rome. I don't think when this idea was spawned, I don't think that's what they had in mind. But I think that's how it's turned out. But they looked to be flying. And in the words of Matthijs de Ligt today, you know, they thought that they were growing into the tournament. But I think they've just underestimated the Czech Republic, who have some excellent players. And also they have a history of struggling against the Czech Republic. If you go back before my time, but it's also a relevant point, 1976 in the European Championships, losing to Czechoslovakia then. People may remember 2004, when they were 2-0 up after 20 minutes, only to lose 3-2 with Vladimir Smica scoring. And I was in the stadium when they were beaten 3-2 in 2015 by the Czech Republic to basically condemn them to not qualify for Euro 2016. And that was a deafening silence. And there were lots of problems behind the scenes, you know, at board level with the Kain Verbeek, the Dutch FA. And they've been cleaned up a little bit. And when I say cleaned up, I don't mean anything that suspicious was going on behind the scenes, but there was just a lot of indecisiveness as to which manager they should go for, as to what type of football they should play. Yeah. And they didn't really know what to do, hence why Dick Advocaat returned again. And when you're in a World Cup qualifying group with France and Sweden, and when you have to go and play in Paris, and when you have to go and play in Solna, it can be very difficult. So it will be very interesting times ahead. You know, this tournament was viewed as a springboard, but unfortunately it's kind of fell flat before it really got started. But hopefully they'll learn a lot. They have to take a lot from the prowess of Denzel Dumfries, who came up the hard way, Eric. You know, I remember when he got promoted with Sparta Rotterdam, and you could tell he was an excellent footballer even then. and took to Eredivisie football like a duck to water, and went to get a secured a transfer to Heerenveen and then subsequently to PSV Eindhoven to captain PSV. I spoke to one of his teammates at Sparta Rotterdam a while back, and he said that when he arrived at the club, you could see he had so much potential. It was just a question of whether he was going to completely tune in and meet that potential. And he's had a good tournament. He's also great spoken.
Tournament. Fantastic.
He's also spoken very well in the media. And for me, it's nice as well because he's come up the traditional way, you know, Sparta Rotterdam, Heerenveen, PSV Eindhoven, and the Dutch national team. There are signs of life in that respect. About Weghorst, the same. Much maligned in the Netherlands, but the fact remains that, you know, when he was scoring goals for AZ Alkmaar, he was getting one goal in every two games. He's gone to Wolfsburg and scored 17 goals in the Bundesliga. And I think that was an oversight today. It appeared that the Dutch media gave the impression that they couldn't play together, Memphis Depay and Weghorst. But they obviously can. But Memphis Depay, he does like the bright lights. He does like the attention. But I think what this tournament has proved is that he can't really lead a team. He's not a out-and-out Van Nistelrooy. He's not an out-and-out Van Basten in terms of being the focal point of an attacking Dutch team.
He touched on everything that I wanted to ask you about here. I was going to ask about Weghorst and whether De Boer should have played Weghorst today instead of Malen and maybe then brought Malen from the bench in the later stages.
Absolutely. I just wanted to touch on it because I thought it was apparent. And, you know, Weghorst, again, someone who I've tracked since his days at Heracles Almelo. And it's about giving young players the opportunity to grow. And although he didn't have a good game today, I think Martin Deroon in flashes had good games, but he didn't play well today. But Martin Deroon is also a very good player. I just think for the Netherlands today, from Amsterdam, it's a massive disappointment. But they will look now to their qualifying campaign for the World Cup, and they will need to finish first. I think they're currently second, but as I say, the away days in Riga and Oslo and at home to Turkey, all three of those games will be key. If they want to finish first, they've got to win all three, in my opinion.
The Czechs will play Denmark in the quarterfinals in Baku, and both teams will believe they have a great chance of getting through to the semis. Denmark thrashed Wales 4-0 and it was comprehensive. They're going from strength to strength. Dolberg hit two, Myler and Martin Brathwaite added two more late on, and it seemed like it was third time lucky for Denmark up front because they started off with Wind as the main striker, then Poulsen, and now it's Dolberg.
Yeah, Denmark look strong. Wales didn't have that opening for 20 minutes where they looked to threaten, but I think maybe the travelling took it out of them. And I think Denmark do have sort of that, you know, 12th man behind them. I think most of Europe, most of the world are supporting Denmark because of what happened to Christian Eriksen. You know, as we mentioned, they're everyone's second team. So the Danes have definitely got the full wind in their sails, shall we say.
What's the mood like in Copenhagen, Jay?
I'm in Copenhagen, and it's really strange. And I mentioned earlier how, you know, Austria seemed to have pulled all the country to back behind them and fallen in love with their national side again. And that is really, really evident here in Denmark. They know everyone, not everyone, but there's a lot of people walking around in their Denmark shirts. There's huge, you know, adverts of, you know, like the Carlsberg, obviously the Danish beer, who sponsor national team, huge billboards all over the city centre with, you know, we're behind you, Denmark, all that kind of thing. And there's flags, you know, flying from windows. People are kind of walking with them draped on themselves. It's really lifted the mood of the country, this tournament. And you have to say that, well done to them, because of it would have been very easy for them to just completely fold. You know, the tragedy with Christian Eriksen, witnessing that, they then lose, obviously, their first two group games. And I think it would have been really easy for them to give up and to just kind of, you know, essentially write it off. And everyone would have forgiven them for just kind of, if they were to just say, you know what, this is unfortunate. All this has happened. You know, our heads are frazzled. We just need a summer off. But it's kind of gone the other way, and it's really pulled that group together and united the country. And as you say, they are now in a fantastic position to reach a semi-final. I think that some people, obviously before the first games, were touting Denmark as dark horses. You know, I'd seen a lot of, obviously Turkey very much made a mockery of their status of dark horse, but Denmark are living up to it. And I think that Denmark are one of those sides, though, like you said, with the strikers. They're a bit like the Czechs in the sense of Dolberg's one of those lads who could bang in two goals against Wales, but then could miss an open goal against the Czech Republic. It's they're really sort of inconsistent strikers in both sides. And ultimately, I think that's why this one might actually be a really interesting game to watch just for a neutral, in that they're two sides who are really going to want to win, and two sides where anything could happen. You don't know if it's going to kind of get to a stage where, but I mean, the Czech Republic aren't really an all-out attacking side, but it might get to a stage where they need to go out on the attack, and you know, Denmark on the counter look very good, and Denmark are this kind of side who are riding a crest of a wave at the moment. And as we saw in that game against Russia and then again against Wales, is when they're on that momentum and they're pushing and they're pushing and they're pushing, they just look capable of, you know, being able to beat anyone on their day. And almost, it almost feels that they want to do it for Christian Eriksen, but also that the side on maybe, this is not meant, obviously not meant as a criticism, not meant to sound harsh, but maybe they are more of a team without him in the 11, just in that Eriksen was, I think we can all say, was definitely their star player. Before the tournament, he was the one that everything would go through. He would take all their set pieces. You know, he's a player who's just won the league with Inter Milan. And maybe when you don't have the kind of the big star man there, everyone else grows into it to replace him. And I think that that's maybe what we've seen with Denmark.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think Denmark are a very well-balanced team now, and Damsgaard's been really good coming in for Eriksen, and they look like the team that everyone said they were going to be, and they just weren't in the first two games for obvious reasons. And on the other hand, while Denmark are riding the crest of a wave, Wales are dead in the water, and defender Chris Gunter called the format of the tournament a joke, and I think he's right. I think Wales have been harshly done by the format, and Portugal to some extent, not playing any of those games at home in the group stage. But beyond that, Wales did look out of their depth against Denmark in Amsterdam. They were a disorganised rabble by the end. They lost their heads. Harry Wilson was sent off for a wild tackle. I don't think it was a red card tackle, but just it was more for the intent and attitude behind it than the actual damage he did when he flung himself in like that. And that's two red cards for Wales at the tournament, and they're just a bit of a mess at the moment.
Yeah, I think you know people can argue about the format of the tournament and how it's being held. I think that's another discussion for another podcast. I can understand both sides of that argument, but ultimately, as you say, Wales looked a bit out of their depth against Denmark, and it's not exactly, they weren't exactly playing, you know, one a team you would class as a heavyweight, a European heavyweight in that sense. So you maybe have to say, you know, that essentially the round of 16 was their level. I thought that they might have actually caused a surprise in this game. So while backing the Czechs, my backing of the Wales were maybe not that wasn't that good a shout. But they just, as you say, they lost their heads a bit. They had to travel a lot, as Gibbo mentioned. So there's always that as well. And essentially tiredness, you know, both physically and mentally after a long season, ultimately looked like it caught up with them. And I do think that they've maybe been a bit harshly given two red cards, because I'm not sure that either of the tackles were red card tackles. I think that the Wilson one was probably more of a red card tackle than the Ampadu one against Italy. However, ultimately Wales were maybe, the round of 16 is probably their level. I think that maybe if they hadn't have had that run to the semi-finals in 2016, everyone would be saying, you know, well done, Wales, because, you know, you've got out of quite a tough group and you've got to last 16 where you had a decent draw and on, you know, had circumstances been different, you might have been able to get through it. But because they got to the semi-finals in 2016, it's almost like this is an inverted commas letdown or an underachievement, when in reality, if you look at their population, you know, they've got players playing in the Championship, the second division in England, who are in that team. You got a lot of players who aren't playing for their clubs, who are substitutes in that as well. So I think that all in all, they've probably done sort of par for the course this year.
All right, that's us over and out. We'll be back on Wednesday for England against Germany reaction, news from the Spain game and all the rest of the matches. Thanks for listening. Share the pod if you enjoy it and do try that free crate of beer from Beer 52. That would help us out and you get 8 craft beers. It's a great deal.
Glug, 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 glug.